Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 5, delivered on September 3, 2015. The title of this lecture is Ratio Analysis.
Today, ratio analysis. The topic of ratio analysis for a finance person should be not an emphasis on the calculation of the numbers as much as on the interpretation of the numbers themselves. Interestingly, though, there is this always this traditional beat-up chapter where you have to remember all the ratios, memorize each and every one of them, and then figure out which one to apply to which situation in the problems. That's what you're facing, and that's why I'm going to extend the number of tries on the homework quiz and tests for Chapter 2, because there's this where do I start, and once you see what I'm doing here, and I'll show you just some examples. Also, all those ratios in those tables on pages 80 and 81 in the textbook, I know it's up on ReggieNet, if you can ever go into ReggieNet, but it's also, I'm going to put it up on the Pearson system, a sheet of ratios. Now, these are not all of the ratios. These are the ratios that were the ones that I used back in the day. Sort of, every analyst will have his favorite set. But there's kind of like this known set that we would all know these, but you can always have that around. And once you have that, print it out, fold it up, and put it in your pocket. And then wherever you go, you can whip that out, and people will back off. You've got financial ratio formulas, okay? Okay, or not. But it's just something as a handy reference guide. It's sort of like the ones that the old timers like me had in our day. Liquidity ratios, like the current ratio, the quick ratio, and there's an old one we used to call the burn ratio, and the book actually shows it. I haven't seen a book show that one in years, but they call it the cash ratio. And then there's some margin ratios that are very important. Now, when I say margin, I'm going to pull up some financials, try to turn this into something real here in just a little bit. But first, if you see a ratio that has margin in it, that means that the denominator is going to be sales, because you're looking at how far away from sales you have fallen. So the three margins are the gross margin, which would be your gross income over your sales. In other words, remember, gross income is revenue minus your cost of goods sold. Cost of goods sold is those wholesale thing prices that you can directly attach to the product. So once I've said, okay, gross income means that that's the money that survived buying wholesale. Basically, I probably might be a dispute a little bit on that. But if I divide that by sales, what that tells me is how many cents of every dollar of sales survived wholesale price. So in other words, if I've got, and I'll do something stupid here, revenue, cost of goods sold, gross income. If I had revenues of, let's say, $10,000, and I had cost of goods sold of $4,000, my gross is $6,000. So the gross margin in this case would be 6,000 over 10,000, which is 60 cents. In other words, 60 cents of every dollar, it would come out to be 0.60. 60 cents of every dollar survived wholesale. That is related to a term I'm sure you've heard somewhere before, markup. the higher your markup over wholesale, the bigger the gross margin is. Now, you'll see gross margins, in other words, it's reflecting markup, all over the board, just like a lot of these. You'll see them all over the board. Sometimes gross margin is just like pennies. Sometimes gross margin is just some knockdown number, like 90 cents of every dollar survived wholesale prices. In other words, the markup is just staggering on the product. And now let me take this down to kind of like more life. Madam, if I were to tell you that I have in a gallery here in this area in Bloomington, a work of my photographic art, frame mat, beautiful picture, big mofo. Okay, and I've got a price of $500 on that. My cost of goods sold on that was $100. So in other words, 100 minus 5 or 400 divided by 500 would be the gross margin, which is 80 cents. Now, am I an evil capitalist running dog greedy? I marked that SOB up 5 times over wholesale. Does that sound greedy? Well, some would say yes, and in other business they say, how are you doing that? Or why are you doing that? Well, I'll talk about that later. But you can see other businesses, they'll have, let's say, a $500 item, but my God, their gross on that thing is like maybe about $30, $40. So their gross margin would be tiny compared to my gross margin. Are they stupid and I'm smart? Are they not evil and greedy and I am evil and greedy? You can't say until you look down farther on the financial statements. But anyway, now there's that operating margin. In other words, you've taken out your wholesale prices. Wholesale. You've also subtracted out the expenses that you can't really attach exactly to an item. Your electric bill, your meals and entertainment, your shipping, your wages and salaries, all those things. Once you've taken out all of the expenses that are part of operations, you get to the operating income line. And so the operating margin would be the operating income over the sales. That's how many cents of every dollar survived all of the operating expenses. So in this case, what would happen here, what would go on in this ratio is that, okay, you'd have sales, general, and administrative expenses, SG&A, probably broken down into wages, utilities, things like that. There's no one formula for it. Depreciation, which isn't really even an expense, is in this one too, but there you go. And you might have all kinds of other expenses, but mostly we say under a broad category, sales, general, and administrative expenses. So here you come down to this operating income line. And I'll do something to see if anyone actually caught what I said the last time. Do you remember what I said the other name you'll see on financial statements for the operating income is? It's EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. It's, like I said, there used to be, you will use this word or this term, especially in SEC filings. But now you'll see operating income, EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. You'll see different terms that mean the same thing. So if you ever hear me say EBIT, I'm actually meaning operating income. Okay, again though, this is how much has survived all of your operating expenses. Your wholesale payouts and all of your office expenses, your salaries, wages, mailing, meals and entertainment. What else do you have? I can't remember. Oh, well, anyway, operating. So the margin is how much of the dollar survived, how many cents of the dollar survived. And finally, you're going to take out your interest. How much did you pay on your borrowings? And that gets you to EBT, earnings before taxes. Let's say your interest expense here is, let's say SG&A is $2,000. There's no reason to use fancy numbers. I'd probably just get it wrong trying to calculate it. $4,000 was your operating. Let's say your interest is $500. Okay, so you got $3,500 EBT, earnings before taxes. Now it's down to basically interest is a fixed expense. Taxes will be a fixed expense. And then you take out your taxes. Let's say that this company tax, and let's just say 20% of it, which is $700. So at the bottom line, okay, $3,500. Will someone help me out? Thank you. God, don't get old. Just shoot yourself before you get to my age. I'm serious. I blocked out there. Net income. There's your net. That is what belongs to the shareholders. And so your net margin is kind of like a big deal, because that is your net income, how much divided by your sales. In other words, how many pennies of every dollar made it to the shareholders' claim. Everything above that has to be satisfied first. That's why we say the shareholders have the residual claim on the cash flows. Write that down. The shareholders have the residual claim on the cash flows of the corporation. Everyone else gets theirs first, and then you get yours. Obligations first, and then ownership last. Did any of you see the movie Cinderella Man? Outstanding movie. There was one scene in it where they were really in bad shape, the family was, and the guy, Russell Crowe, he's sitting there at the table, and his little girl, mom, cut off a thin slice of this bologna for each, for the little girl and for Russell Crowe, the dad. And, you know, he started saying, you know, I had this incredible dream last night where I was just so in this incredible restaurant, and I ate all this great food. And, you know, I'm not hungry this morning. And he gave her his piece of bologna to the kid. The wife says, oh, honey, no. And he said, no, I'm full. I got to go to work. That's that concept. You get yours after your obligations are paid, putting it into real life terms. And so at this point, net income. Now, getting the technicalities a little bit aside, this net income can be all over the board. You can have a net income of 20.25. In other words, 25 cents of every dollar of sales got to the shareholders line. You can have others where you have a 0.01 or less, a penny of the say every dollar of sales got to where the shareholders could have claim to it. It's all over the place. Now, you have to, and it doesn't mean a company is in bad shape if it has a tiny, tiny net margin. What kind of a company, very healthy, would have a very small net margin, like a penny or two, 0.02? You got an idea of what kind of company would do that, have that? It doesn't occur to you right away. Oil companies, giant manufacturing companies, companies that specialize in little screws and other types of what are called fasteners, companies that specialize in little trinkets and toys and things like that. They are huge corporations. So think about it. If you got a corporation with global sales of $100 billion and only a penny survives to the bottom line, you've still got one hellaciously good company on your hand. The shareholders are just as happy as they can be. It's a scale of operations. So as you scale up, you can have your net margin sliding downward because you've got tons of fixed costs and operating costs in a company and variable costs in companies like that. It's just insane, all of your costs. But at a sufficiently large scale of operations, you are still going to make a fortune. That's why you can have an idea. for a kind of store. Okay, well, this store isn't going to make... did I mention Dollar Tree in the last lecture? Okay, I love Dollar Tree. $10, 10 Christmas gifts. Who can beat that? Aldi's is a love child of Wall Street. Those companies on any given day, a Dollar Tree and Aldi's, after they've paid their employees their light bills, they might have from their revenue line of maybe $100. Down at the bottom line, the net margin might be $5. But you have 10,000 stores, $5 each, $50,000 a day, 360 days a year. And even if one store burns down, who cares? Even if you have a meteor hit a state, you've still got the vast majority of your stores. Low risk, vastly distributed sales. It is it's an engine. It's a money engine. It's the scale that matters. There's in our day, in our time, we have this idea of the what's called the Hail Mary. You throw this long ball of high-priced products, and after you've sold 100 of them, you can retire. That wasn't the old days way of doing it. Those, like, for example, one of the famous candy manufacturers, his policy was to just make millions and millions and millions of little candies, bubble gums, chewies, all those kinds of things. And on each one of those, he might make 0.0001 cents. But you sell a billion of those in a year, and you got yourself a winner of an organization. Little candies, little toys, little screws and nuts and bolts. That's why don't flip out on a company if you just see a sharp, narrow net margin or something like that. That might just mean that the company is of such large scale that it doesn't have to worry about having a huge hit from the sales down to the net. So keep that in mind. And also keep that in mind if you ever want to be an entrepreneur. Don't always look for the huge seller, the one that has a massive markup. Believe me, having a massive markup is great when you sell. It sucks when you don't sell anything, as has happened to me many times. Okay, those are the margins. Taking you out. Okay, moving on. Look, there are all of these different ratios that I could talk to you about. The list is almost endless. And I really always have the book or the table with you. When you take the quiz or the test, I wouldn't even ask you to try to memorize these. Because if you use them enough, the ones that you really care about, you'll remember what they are. But other than that, there's no crime. Every financial analyst I ever knew had a book of ratios right there where he or she could reach for it. So there's nothing wrong with having that thing ready for you. A couple of other ratios that are important to us that I'm just going to bring up, and then I'm going to show you a couple of things where they're trying to, it's almost like they're trying to trick you in the book. But let's try a couple here. The liquidity ratios. The current is your current assets over your current liabilities. In other words, how many times over can your liquid assets pay off your liquid debts? Did you ever see the movie Zombieland? What has happened these days? Night of the Living Dead. Did you see that? No. Z. That Brad Pitt movie. Yeah. What the hell? Don't people watch zombie movies? Okay, there are going to be zombies someday. And the zombies are coming toward your company. We've got to pay off our liabilities because those aren't just normal zombies. Those are debt collector zombies. Do you know what that means? They're capitalists? I'm sorry. It's just the world we live in. Okay? This is just how many times over can you get rid of your current stuff and pay off those zombies so they'll go away? Those current zombies. These are the fast ones, the ones that move fast. The long-term zombies, those are easier, but these fast zombies, they'll come at you. So you got to know how many times over you can take care of them if you liquidate the stuff that's easier to liquidate. The problem with that one, this current ratio, there's another one called the quick. We use just old terminology. We used to call this the acid test, and you'll hear me call it acid to this day. This one is your current assets, but you take away that inventory there in the current assets. Because realistically, inventory, you're going to get pennies on the dollar. If you have to liquidate it right away, you'll call one of those liquidation services, and you'll say, I've got $1 million worth of inventory I got to get rid of now. They're going to say, yeah, we got $100 for you. Really, that's all that is. I mean, so inventory really isn't all that meaningful in sale to someone else rapidly. It is incredibly meaningful to you because that's how you're going to generate sales. But to some company that just odd lots buy stuff, they're going to buy it pennies on the dollar. So take that out and then divide by current liabilities. So this says how many times over can honestly, liquid assets be sold. Remember, part of liquidity is not just how fast you can sell it, but do you have to pay a lot to sell it? You can flip a CD right away, but you're going to pay a substantial interest penalty for early withdrawal. So take away the inventory. Now, another one that is useful in this list, really, you've all had accounting. Who is account? Are you an accounting major? Thank God. You're an accountant. No, you're not. Oh, I know I've got accounting majors in here. Don't hide. It's okay. Yeah, accounting major. Accounting? Okay, never mind. What else? You've all had your damn accounting. So what else is in the current assets besides inventory? Anything else? Can you remember? Huh? Cash, yes. What was the other one? No, that's long. That's long. Accounts receivable. That's not going to sell very well. You get a factoring company. Factoring companies are all over the place. They'll buy your accounts receivable any day of the week. But they're going to buy it for pennies. I mean, there's a company here in town. I won't mention its name. That's all they do is just buy accounts receivable. Loans that are people didn't pay a bill, they buy it years later and try to bully the people into paying it, even though they can't really. But I won't mention the name of that company. But these factoring companies are out there all over the place, but they're going to pay pennies on the dollar. You got $1 million in accounts receivable, they'll go through the quality of the receivables, and you might see anywhere for $1 million, maybe $2,000 on up to maybe $100,000, but you ain't going to get much. So the reality is that we want something that is real. This is where I'll use the book's term, but I'll tell you the old term. The old term was burn ratio, but the book calls it the cash ratio. And this is just your cash and marketable securities. In other words, what you got in money market funds over your current liabilities. This is the one. Okay. You and I were the last people standing in the company. The zombies are coming at us. Okay? We know what those zombies want, don't we? We know. So, really, I say, I'm going to go down and get the inventory to throw at them. And you say, no, you dumbass. They won't eat that. And then you say, I'll get our accounts receivable to throw at them. No, you dumbass. Finally, it comes down to, all right, what is it they want? And what do you say? Yes, that's all they want. They're zombies. They have no feelings. Okay? That's it. In other words, let's get real. Let's get real here. If you had to pay off your liabilities tomorrow, none of that other stuff on the current assets of the balance sheet are going to mean diddly to the collectors. So get down to how much cash you have. Now, this is kind of a tricky thing, though. This is actually kind of an interesting number. I don't run into it as much now as I used to. Did you ever, were you ever told in an accounting class or something, maybe in high school or so, or in another class, that you should always match current liabilities to current assets and all that? Yeah, that's false. That's one possible management style, cash management style. There are all kinds of different ones. Some companies have this current ratio at 5-7. Some companies have the current ratio down at 0.5. Even at the current assets line. And then also, one interesting thing is that in a lot of these companies, I told you this in another lecture, I think, is that we've got a lot of these companies that are just amassing cash reserves, just huge amounts of it. For what purpose? It could be for several purposes, but there are usually a couple. But so sometime in the modern times, in the last maybe 10 years, 5 years, especially in the last 5 years, you'll see some companies, the big 800-pound gorillas, with these current ratios that are just getting bloated and swollen because these companies are just amassing so much cash. And it's kind of disturbing in a way. Why are they doing that? Well, part of it, let me ask you, what would motivate a company to amass a lot of cash? What would you say? Why would you have tons of cash in your pockets instead of having it in your bank account? Huh? Well, that's possible, but over a long period of time, wouldn't you think that they'd figure out better investments? Cash doesn't really give you a good return. You know, it's liquid, so you're not going to get a higher return. You get a higher return by putting it into long-term investments. Huh? Hard to tell. They might be just instead of using cash, as I had mentioned before, they might just borrow so they get the gains to leverage and just keep the cash. But what would this cash still be for, though? That's a good idea, and we do see that in some cases. Like Netflix. They have plenty of cash, and I'm going to show you Netflix again here in a minute. They have plenty of cash, but then they go out and borrow money. So it's like hoard this cash. What in the world would that be about? Well, that's something that there is a lot of debate about. There is not an answer. We can ask them, and they'll just give you ask a company anything, and they'll give you a stock answer. You can't believe it. You have to ask. Okay, you have to ask yourself. Okay, why are you doing this? You shave, you put on a nice pair of pants and a decent shirt polo, and you trim that unibrow down a little bit. And I say, well, why are you doing that? And you say, well, I just feel like I need to look more professional these days. And okay, that's fine. And then I walk away, bullshit. You're sitting next to a girl in this class that you like. Okay, you actually bathed last night, didn't you? I know what's going on. Don't ever believe everything that is told you. We have to say things in stylized ways, and we have to protect corporate intentions, especially if we have plans to start raiding other companies, just taking over, grabbing, gobbling. We're not going to say, yeah, we're about to start raiding companies, grabbing and gobbling. Let me tell you which ones we're going to do. Yeah, that's the first thing that's going to drive the price of their companies up so that when we do raid them, they're going to be a lot more expensive than if we just quietly waited for them to walk by like little lambs and we just go, like that, okay? You don't signal what you don't want to signal. You signal what you do want to signal. Okay, that's liquidity ratios. Really, I'm always curious about this one, though, because that's kind of the one that tells me about the bloat. I almost want to call this one the bloat ratio now, just so I can see, all right, which ones of these companies are doing this big bloated thing these days? And there are other ratios. A couple that are always important are ROE and ROA, return on equity and return on assets. Return on equity is your net income divided by your book equity. Now, when I say book equity, that's the number that's on the balance sheet. One that is more interesting, remember I showed you market cap? That's market equity. I really like that one a lot better. Book equity is just what's on the balance sheet. And that really doesn't mean a whole lot. Total stockholders' equity is $32 million. So, I don't care. It really doesn't have a whole lot of meaning. A good way to explain this was an incident I saw in a company when I was in the back in the day of consulting. They were talking about a project that was going to run more than $1 million. And one of the people in there, he kind of had an accounting background, finance background, and he was a bright young man, but he said, and we were talking about financing, paying for this project, and he said, well, why can't we just write a check out of equity, out of retained earnings? He saw the financial statements, and the retained earnings had a huge number on it, which, of course, leads to a large stockholder's equity. And one of the old geezers in there said, son, can you show me the checking account that says retained earnings? And the young man didn't quite get it at first. And he said, and finally the old man said, okay, listen, there's no such thing as retained earnings, not in real life. Retained earnings is a placeholder, a number that we have to calculate for financial reporting purposes. But there is no such thing as retained earnings. There's no checking account called retained earnings. There is no drawer in our offices anywhere that says retained earnings are found here. That doesn't really exist. And so always keep in mind when we say book, we're talking about a number that is created for reporting purposes. Important reporting purposes, but just reporting purposes nonetheless. So always keep that in the back of your mind. But anyway, net income is what's the shareholder's money. Book equity is what the shareholders have put into the corporation. So that number, net income over return on equity, net income divided by book equity is essentially a measure of what kind of an investment the shareholders have made. Now another one. Return on assets is net income over total assets. Total assets are what you got. Net income is what you made for the shareholders. Return on assets is telling you how much did those assets do for you. You buy all the equipment for a company. You got your receivables, your inventory, your giant factories, your trucks, whatever. All of that together created for the shareholders the net income. So when you divide net income by total assets, what you're actually seeing is what was the yield those assets did for the corporation. So as that yield goes down, those assets aren't doing as much for you. As yield goes up, those assets are doing more for you. So, here's the bottom line of that one. Higher ROA is always a good thing, right? Wrong. You see, the great example of this, and there are other ratios, and you can probably figure them out, these asset turnover ratios and all these ones that I don't even bother to show you. Here's the deal. You can take a set of assets and work them and work them and work them. In the 1970s, the last oil refineries were built in the United States. Ever since then, those same refineries have been working more and more. So net income just keeps going up and up, and your total asset base doesn't go up. Well, spank me, Jesus. Return on assets just keeps going up and up and up. Awesome. Unbelievable. And then in the first decade of the 21st century, at one story after another, refinery explodes, 87 workers killed. Refinery burns to the ground, 37 killed. Refinery explodes, town evacuated, number of casualties unknown as of this report. They burned the assets up. They didn't cultivate, they didn't reinvest, they didn't build their asset base. You are my slave, okay? You're not the greatest, but I mean, you were on sale, so. And I used my discount coupon at Floggings R Us. And I get you out there, and I start working you. Now, you have some of these people like me. You know, they'll feed you, they'll educate you, they'll teach you all kinds of new skill sets and all that. Me, I get you out there, work, work. You stand there in the hot sun every day, sweaty, muscular.
your face is getting so red.
Anyway, you see, I can do that. And he just keeps working and working and working. Part of it turns out that the Duchess is going out there to help feed you, take care of you every day when I'm away, horseback riding with the young men that I take care of. But I used to teach at Penn State. But too soon? Anyway. But here's the deal, though. I'm going to burn you up. You're going to be dead. 4 years, and then I'm going to come out there one day, and there you'll be, lying there. Flies around you. The whole nine yards. You understand what's happened here is that I burned you up. Now, let's talk about this in other companies that would probably, you probably wouldn't know about the refinery industry, but let's talk about other companies. We have companies like JCPenney and Sears. What was the fundamental reason that those companies nearly died? Do you know it? Have you been into a JCPenney? Have you ever gone to JCPenney?
Maybe once.
Maybe once. Why?
I don't go shopping. Oh,
I see your shirt, obviously. Yeah. They haven't changed. That's not grandma's store. That's great-great-great-grandma's store in there. They even have that same stupid bell that I used to hear as a kid. Boom, boom, boom. I don't know what that bell is. I thought maybe it was a cowbell, and I wanted more cowbell. But Sears, the same thing. The same product, the same layout, the same clothes that they sold to my grandma's aunt. And they never innovated.
No, people like our old-fashioned style.
No, they don't. No, no. I go in there, and I feel old. And I can't feel old because I am old. When I feel old, that means that the Grim Reaper is right behind me. Okay? Okay, now let's talk about a company that just a few years ago revamped all of its stores, turned them, put groceries in them, put in even kickier merchandise. They're always innovating, always advertising, always trying to pull in the young people. What company am I talking about? Target. For heaven's sakes, get real. We're upscale bastards here, okay? And of course, guess what? ROA went to hell. Their net income went to hell, and these analysts, well, they're in real trouble. I recommend that you sell that stock. No, you dumbass. That company did what it had to do. It's just like in a race car competition. You see those cars spinning around the track? They pull off, and they lose their lead position for a while because they have to have gas put in the car, tires change, and all that kind of stuff. It's part of real growth. And so you can't really look at ROA at any given point in time. You have to look at it over a period of time. What is it doing? Oh, ROA sucks. Well, that might be because this company actually did something called modernizing and all that kind of stuff. So you can't take these numbers at face value. You have to look at trends. Do it for a few years, and then you'll know a lot more. Now, let me show you this thing that these books do sometimes. It drives me crazy when they do it. But okay. A couple of ratios here might be useful. Dividend yield. That is the dividends per share divided by the earnings per share, EPS, which is a fancy way. Now, I was actually told that in accounting, they say earnings isn't this. But earnings is just really another name for a net income. Earnings per share, but we say EPS, earnings per share, because it makes us sound butch. Earnings per share. Market price per share. Duh. Okay. In other words, you buy a stock for $100. The dividend is $2. So basically, you got a 2% return on your investment. But you put in $100, you get $2 back every year. That's a 2% return. So that dividend yield kind of tells you the dividend part of your gains. Now remember, the stock price can go up too. That's separate. That's called capital gains. But the dividend yield would tell you your how much you earned in money per year on an investment. And you'll see the dividend yield all over the place. Some companies, there's a zero dividend yield. They don't pay a dividend. They're just plowing everything back into the company, growing the stock price. Other companies have really high dividends for one reason or another. In other words, they just get their money on the bottom line and they give most of it back to the shareholders. There are some companies that have to do that. There's a kind of odd kind of company called an REIT, Real Estate Investment Trust. They're required by law at the end of every year to disgorge, I think it's like 95% of their net income back to their shareholders. And that way they're protected from taxes and a lot of other things. And they just keep selling stock to grow their base. They're like giant souffles. And they're the kinds of companies that buy everything from apartment complexes to shopping malls. In recent years, this Bank of America guy he made my jaw drop. He was talking about, he's in charge of REITs, REITs. He said, yeah, we've got a whole set of REITs for some real new stuff. We're buying forest REITs. In other words, they just buy forests. They wipe them out, send the profit to their shareholders, and then they sell more stock and go on and buy more forests. There are REITs, REITs. He said his favorite are prison REITs. They buy prisons from states, and then they run them as a corporation. And then when they sell it, or when they make the income off the prison by making the inmates work at almost no wage and selling products like that, and the state pays them to take care of the inmates, they just, at the end of every year, they just turn it all back over to the shareholders. And then the next year, if they want to buy more prisons, they just sell more stock in the REIT and go forward. Creepy stuff. I mean, REITs were started in the 1960s. I think in 1960, there was an act of Congress that said, we want to improve the housing stock, apartments for more people. So REITs were originally developed to do things like apartments, maybe even housing developments, shopping malls, stuff like that. But they have expanded a lot. So you'd see a REIT, massive dividends on a REIT. Almost all the money goes to the shareholders at the end of every year. But in some companies, I'm trying to, right off the top of my head, what's a company that doesn't pay a dividend? Netflix? I don't think they pay a dividend. So the dividend yield there would be zero. So dividend yield. So let me write a problem here. A company has net income of $500,000 of which the company plowed back $400,000 to its 10,000 shareholders. I'm pulling this one out of my head because I can't remember the numbers that I thought of before class. I hope this works out fairly well. If the dividend yield is 5%, what's the current market price of the stock? Did you notice problems like this in the homework and the quiz? What they're actually asking you to do is an algebra puzzle. This is why I'm not sure what the value of this exercise is. But all they're asking you to do is to play with the numbers until you get things that should cancel to cancel. Look, and there's no formula I can tell you for every problem, but I can show you the approach. Okay, I know the dividend yield is dividends per share over price per share, market price per share. There's the number I need. That's what they're asking for. Okay, I got the dividend yield. It's 5%. So at least I've got one thing in here. I need this. So this has got to be, I've got to be able to find this. There's got to be a way to find that. Because once I find that, I can just do algebra. So how do I find that? Well, they said net income was 500 grand. Okay. What can the company do with its net income? There are two things that the company can do with its net income. Can you tell me what they are? What are the two things a company can do with its income?
Pay dividends or
back into the company. Bingo. So, in other, she said they can either pay a dividend or they can plow back into the company. Oh, plowback. Well, we know the plowback was 400 grand. Well, that means that they had to have paid the rest of it out as a dividend, 100 grand. Well, we're almost there. Thank God. Dividend. Okay, dividend per share would then be 400,000. How many shares does this company have outstanding? What is it? What is it? What did I say there? 10,000? The dividend, so the dividend per share, what the hell is that? They paid a $40 per share dividend. What? Yeah. Oh, I'm just testing you. I just wanted to see if you would catch that mistake that I made. You did. That's good. I was worried that. The hell with you. I have destroyed. I have ruined more companies with my bad math. That 40 was actually freaking me. I thought, no, $40, nah, that's an awfully large dividend. I'd be way too generous with those shareholders considering how little they respect me. Okay. Thank you for catching that, because I would have really been on. You should have just let me go until the end and then point out the mistake that I made back there, so I had to redo the whole thing. Okay. Finally, we have 5%. Equals, well, I know the dividend per share is $10 divided by the price per share, so now I can just do a cross multiply. 5%, would be the price per share would be $10 over 0.05, which means that the price per share of the stock is $200. That's what they're trying to get you to do, is to just keep pushing the numbers around until you, and find the formulas for the things that they tell you, and then see how you can work them around until you get to where you want to be. Is there an easy way to do this? No. And do you ever get completely used to it? I never did. And that's why I'm giving you 3 shots on the quiz and the exams. You've got infinite time. Now, don't take infinite time. You've got other things to do with your life. But at the same time, there it is for you, for what it's worth. Anyway, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.